Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane. There are many concerns about Trump being president, from his support for white nationalists to his many violations of the Constitution, such as attacking freedom of the press. We have discussed many of these concerns on this show. But consider for a moment if there might be an upside to having someone who shatters the norms of Washington, D.C. For example, what if his smashing of norms might help open a wider discussion on America's role in the world? The world has changed, both in terms of power relationships among nations and in terms of the issues we face, from climate crisis to global terrorism. What should the U.S. role be in today's changing world? Here to talk about rethinking the U.S. role in the world is Gordon Adams, a high-level Washington insider who is willing to challenge consensus views in Washington. Gordon was the senior White House official for national security and foreign policy budgets in the Clinton administration. He was the defense and foreign policy lead for the incoming Obama administration transition team at the Office of Management and Budget. He was a professor at both American University and George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He's the founder and director of the Defense Budget Project, one of Washington, D.C.'s leading research centers working on the defense budget, defense economics, and defense policy issues. He's with us here today. Gordon Adams, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. Thank you for having me.
So, Gordon, you have been in leadership at the highest levels of government on defense and national security, and you see that the world has changed, but the groupthink in Washington has not changed. Can you explain what you think has changed in the world that requires new approaches not now reflected in the groupthink in D.C.?
Sure. Let's start with the idea that we have, all of us, a set of language that we've gotten used to over the years that tells us what the American role in the world is and supposed to be. We are the exceptional nation. We are, as Madeleine Albright put it, the indispensable nation. Others have called us the global peacekeeper. We're the guarantor of a rules-based international order. Our military is the keeper of the global commons. We are, in some, the leader of the free world, as you will hear repeatedly on American media, coming out of the mouths of policymakers, coming out of the mouths of politicians. All that language describes a fairly comfortable set of assumptions that we've had about our role in the world for a long time. But, and it's a very big but, the world has changed dramatically, and it makes most of those shibboleths, because that's what they are, no longer relevant to how we have to deal in the world. The biggest change is that power among nations has permanently shifted. It's been continually shifting. This is more than just China. It's not just a question of China rising, but it's a question of the Russians playing a relatively weak playing hand in statecraft terms, but playing it well. It's about Turkey staking out an independent position in the region and in the world. It's about Iran asserting power in the Middle East despite what we say. It's about the Saudis and the Gulf Cooperation Council countries doing the same thing. It's about India creating its own military. It's about the Germans distancing themselves from American policy. And all these power shifts were happening even before Donald Trump. This is not a question of Trump. This is a question of a really tectonic shift. It's like an earthquake around the globe, where other countries are asserting themselves, acquiring power, behaving in important ways in settling and causing regional disputes. And the United States is no longer in this position of being the sole superpower who basically called the tune while everybody else danced. I think it's important to say that Trump is not the cause of this change. This is an underlying change in global relations. He's not the cause. I like to call Donald Trump the accelerant. His firefighters would say it's the person who pours the gasoline on the fire that's already started. And fundamentally, there's no way to go back to the old order, the indispensable nation, the exceptional nation, the rules-based guarantor, the leader. Leadership is now completely different in meaning. Add to this, Eleanor, that the agenda of what is an international security issue has also changed enormously. Migration is a major issue. Income equality and inequality is a major international issue. Climate change is a raging threat to the security of all countries around the globe. And what's the characteristic of all of these issues in common? It is that no one nation, including the United States, can solve them. They literally demand multilateral action. Otherwise, they're not solvable. So we've got a change in power. We've got a change in the issue agenda from where we were in the Cold War. And all of these say it's time for the U.S. to really step back and reconsider how it engages the world.
That is a really profound analysis, and I think exactly right, of what's going on. And yet, what you say makes so much sense, but the establishment in D.C. seems not to understand that or to change. It's like we're stuck in some kind of time warp back to the end of World War II when the U.S. was the dominant world power. But that was 75 years ago, and as you rightly point out, a lot has changed. Why do you think the foreign policy establishment in D.C. does not recognize these changes?
I think the old way of viewing the world, the leadership indispensability, we can step back into our old world view, simply makes sense to a lot of policymakers. It's what they have heard for decades. It's the mantra that's familiar. It also makes them, and to some extent the American public, feel good. We're number one was a long-term mantra of American thinking. So it's very familiar to them. Recalibrating for a very different world means breaking up a lot of the old ways of doing business. And in a sense, let me say that one of the people in Washington who's not part of this consensus is Donald J. Trump.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating because Trump, by being kind of unpredictable, off the wall, idiosyncratic, narcissistic, all of the things that Donald Trump clearly is, he has blown up the architecture of the old order. And so you have people scrambling around, Republicans trying to figure out whether they want to be friends with Russia or enemies, Democrats deciding being an enemy of Russia is a way to get around Trump, who seems to be cozying up to Vladimir Putin. So all the old game is being ripped apart by a totally idiosyncratic president. His embrace of dictators around the world is totally contrary to the mantra of supporting democracy around the world. He has taken literally the grip of the handle on the explosive charge and blown up the old order. It creates a really incredible opportunity for rethinking how we engage the world, because he simply made the old rules no longer functional. But since they're very familiar to those in power, and since they're rules that in a sense encourage business as usual, and business as usual is to the benefit of some financial interests, it's the benefit of some corporate interests, keeping this old structure going is a way of benefiting those interests, it's a way of engaging in a familiar way, it's a way of scoring political points. It is not only counterproductive, it is dangerous. It's counterproductive because other countries, when we intervene, push us back and resist. So we're creating the very power shift that we choose to ignore by trying to do this. And it's dangerous because, particularly in military intervention, interventions of this kind cause serious regional blowback. There's no more concrete example of this than the war in Iraq, which removed a relatively stable balance of power in that region and threw it to the winds. We didn't replace Iraq as a regional power balancer. We don't have the capacity to play that role. But we let the Iranians into the game. We helped create a foster a Turkish interest in an independent policy. We have the Saudis playing independently. All of these things that we have done trying to reimpose the old rules have simply blown up the architecture of regional security in the Middle East, just to cite one example. So I think the answer to your question, Eleanor, is it's in the interest of people in power to try to remember the old rules that kept them in power while they were there.
Right. I think that's true. And I think you put your finger right on it when you said not only the foreign policy establishment, all the think tanks and writers and thinkers, but also the American people. You know, we like to think U.S. is number one. We liked it when we were the major superpower policemen of the world, more or less. I mean, there were some complaints about the cost of the military and all that, but that essentially a lot of Americans are proud that we are or were the world leader, the go-to person to help bring peace to the world, bring democracy to the world. I think that deep down may be the deepest resistance to recognizing some of the changes that have taken place. You've thought a lot about this. Do you have any ideas, like, how do we get at that core sense that we're proud as Americans to be the police of the world, and we're reluctant emotionally and psychologically to recognize that that's no longer true?
Here's something that I think Donald Trump tapped into, maybe inadvertently, but very really. The question that you raise, Eleanor, really is the conundrum of how do you define something different? You know, and so people spend a lot of time worrying about how to reassure the Americans that we're still the most powerful country in the world and we're still number one. The real answer is blowback, because continually reasserting that role is causing blowback against the United States and blowback against American interests. So in a sense, part of the way of changing it is to recognize that we are creating the very disorder that we purport to be able to control. That's part of the answer. But what Donald Trump tapped into, which I think is fascinating, is he tapped into people's dissatisfaction with the idea that we had to go around and fix all the world's problems. There's very deep dissatisfaction now, stimulated by the war in Iraq, stimulated by the 5,000-plus American men and women who died in the war in Iraq, stimulated by all those people who've come back, veterans in the streets of America with PTSD and drug issues and homelessness. All of that has led a substantial portion of the American people to say, wait a minute, we don't really have to do this. This may not be in our interests. And surprisingly, this idea that we have been endlessly in war from 2001 to 2019, because we're still in Afghanistan, people have begun to wake up and smell the coffee and say, you know, maybe this wasn't such a good idea for us to assert ourselves the role of being the global organizer of world order. We've got some issues that we've got to take care of back here at home. We need the resources to take care of those issues. And maybe other people ought to be taking on greater responsibility for security and peace in their own regions. Trump tapped into that sentiment and ran on it. And it's one of the most interesting contradictions in the Trump administration, is to see the John Boltons of the world eagerly and busily trying to create conflict with North Korea, with Iran, and having the President of the United States, out of some kind of crazy instinct, say, no, you know, I thought about it. I don't think an hour and a half before they're supposed to fly, I actually want to fire missiles into Iran. So let's scrap that order. Or to say, you know, we ought to be negotiating with the North Koreans, not bombing their nuclear program back into the Stone Age. So why don't we do some talks? And as crazy as he is in terms mm-hmm. of the way he lays that down, it opens the window to saying, hey, to the American people, to say, you know, maybe we don't have to run everything. Now, I'll hasten to add that I don't think the Trump administration has a single coherent policy in any area of the world, and they have no idea what to do about it. You know, he's come up zero by canceling the Iranian nuclear accord. He's come up zero by becoming Kim Jong-un's best friend. He's come up zero trying to impose different set of trading relations with China. He has yet to score an international policy win in 2.5 years in the presidency. And it's because he's so unpredictable and idiosyncratic, and nobody thinks there's a policy, and he has weakened the diplomatic instruments of the United States government that should be advising him, and he takes advice from nobody. And we know all of these things. So it means he doesn't really have a policy to go with his opposition to endless war, his opposition to intervention, his opposition to nation building. There's kind of no there when it comes to what does that really mean? And what does American policy then do? How should we design it, implement it? How should we be behaving? There's no answer to that question in the Trump administration, but he has certainly blown up the expectation that we ought to be number one everywhere in the world all the time.
I think you're right, and I think it actually was part of Trump's appeal in the 2016 election was that he spoke right out front about the United States not being policeman of the world anymore and bringing those resources back home. I think we've now had at least six wars, more if you count the war against ISIS and Al-Qaeda, but we've had six wars in the recent past costing us over $6 trillion, thousands of lost lives here, hundreds of thousands of lost lives in the Mideast and elsewhere, and yet we're less secure than we were when we started. This is all since 9/11. So I think people are war-weary and just enough already, and we're looking at the fact that we've got 40% of Americans cannot meet a bill of $400 in a month, unexpected expense. So many of the middle class have slipped down and are more economically fragile and insecure than we were. So people are going, we want to take care of Americans here in the United States. Let's settle our own issues. So I think you're right. I think Trump tapped into that. And in spite of the to-ing and fro-ing and the bombast that he's done, he has not started any additional wars. Now, we may be on the verge of that tomorrow with a belligerent act towards Iran or towards Korea, so that might change. But you're right, we're 2.5 years into the Trump administration, and he hasn't started another war, so we can be grateful for that. But I'm interested, I think you're right, I think that we're number one thing, you know, people are feeling the effect of endless wars, the cost of blood and treasure, and the need for getting those resources back home. But the advantage Trump brings is he's challenged and, as you say, blown up the consensus around U.S. as super police of the world. But there's no coherent policy to replace it. You are brilliant, and you have spent virtually a lifetime thinking about defense and national security at the highest levels in our government and in the think tanks that influence government policy. If you were advising the next president of the United States, what do you think the shape of the new policies should be, given that we've had this kind of blow-up happen, but we've had the lack of coherence of what to replace? What do we replace it with? What would you advise the next president?
Well, that's a huge question, but it's the right question. Obviously, from my point of view, the first piece to try to communicate to the American people is that the world has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And we can no longer simply say frog and expect other countries to jump. Right? Number two, other countries are, in fact, much more capable than we've given them credit for in dealing with the regional economic and political and security issues that we have and that they face on a regional basis. So thinking, you know, sort of letting go is going to be hard to do, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
But letting go in this case is saying, yes, it's not a question of saying, oh, you go and take care of it in an angry way. It's a case of saying you are as capable as we are, perhaps more so, in figuring out what the route is to stability and growth and good jobs and peace in the Middle East, for example. And the Middle East, I think, is a good litmus test for the proposition that I'm putting forward here. In a way, one of the most useful American positions in the Middle East, I think, is for the United States to, in fact, in the Middle East, not more. Being more of a player and attempting to position ourselves as the peacemaker, peacekeeper, order keeper, the country that goes to war with the bad guys in order to get them out of office, like Saddam Hussein or like the Ayatollahs in Tehran, to say, no, that's not a sensible policy for America. We can't do that. And in fact, what we ought to be doing is encouraging the nations in the region to set up an architecture of stability themselves. Interestingly, in the Middle East, you know, I like to call it growing flowers up through the cracks in the pavement. The broken pavement is the chaos and disorder in the Middle East, which our Iraq invasion played a big role in stimulating. But it's not the only role. There are major players in the Middle East, and they are playing more independently than they used to. The Turks, the Saudis, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Iran, Oman, Egypt, they are all countries in that region who have a complex set of relationships with each other, which they're going to have to work out or there will be no stability. What's interesting to me is to see the Israelis begin to do a lot of conversations with many of the GCC states, the Gulf Cooperation Council states in the Gulf, and with the Saudis. For the Israelis in this current administration in Israel, the interest is really in creating a coalition against Iran. But for heaven's sakes, 20 years ago, when I went to the Middle East for the Clinton administration, the Israelis weren't talking to the Saudis. The Israelis were only talking to the Egyptians and the Jordanians. There's a much broader conversation, and there's a realization in the region that as the United States becomes less involved, because Trump doesn't seem to want to go to war yet, that they are going to have to solve their problem themselves. And as the Saudis are learning in Yemen, it's not a problem they solve through the use of military force. The Saudis have been inept and unsuccessful in their struggle against the Houthis in Yemen. There is a common interest in the Gulf in being able to ship oil supplies out of the Gulf. That is a common interest shared by Shiite and Sunni regimes alike, right? There are some natural bases, in other words, for a resolution of the security situation in the Middle East, and it will take time and it will not be easy, that do not necessarily involve the United States coming in, taking sides, as Trump has done with the Israelis and the Saudis, or even trying to mediate at this point, because nobody's looking to the United States to be the mediator. You know, it's fascinating to see the Europeans begin to get their act together in terms of oil shipping security in the Gulf. What I'm saying, I'm describing a complex reality in the Gulf in which the United States is not the major player.
Mm-hmm.
We've lived for years with this myth that if the United States pulled back from the world, chaos would result. That's a standard myth of what we call the blob, the people who make foreign policy and have for 70 years in the United States. If we don't do it, nobody will. Well, guess what? If we're not doing it, we may be standing at the edge, we may be contributing something, but if we're just cooperating in regional processes, lo and behold, it turns out countries in a region are perfectly capable of arranging their own security relationships with each other. And it isn't saying the United States is going to withdraw and become an isolationist nation. It says we're not going to take on the assumption that things only happen because we make them happen. And when we pull back a little bit, other things happen. And it turns out countries in the region can make those other things happen. That is, as I said at the beginning, something that began to happen some 15 or 20 years ago. Trump has accelerated that process. But the going-in presumption of a new administration should not be, we're going to go back in and restore the old order. We're going to go back into all of these organizations and be the leader. We're going to tell other countries what to do again. We are the indispensable nation. Everybody will have to listen to us. We're going to maintain an architecture of military bases around the world because we and only we can guarantee security on the high seas, in the air, and in space. None of these things are true. They're also counterproductive. So the first thing is attitude. You got to be able to come to the world with a different set of understandings. And I think the diving board for that, if you will, the springboard for that difference in attitude lies directly in what Donald Trump has done to blow up the old system. That it is now possible to say we need to engage differently. We don't need to be involved with every problem. If you poll that statement, we don't need to be solving any problem in the world, it wins overwhelming support from the American people. Right? They recognize they want to do this, and you know the next set of unemployed veterans on the street corner that can't get a job and can't cope with housing, tells them this was something probably unwise to do in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the touchstone. That's the point of entry into saying we have to engage in a different way, because people now begin to accept we shouldn't be worrying about being number one. You know, if we're worried about number one, let's make us number one in education. Let's make us number one in infrastructure investment. Let's make us number one in the treatment of women and treatment of minorities. Let's make us number one in the reestablishment of democracy at home. Let's not spend so much time trying to run the affairs of other countries and being what we thought was the world guarantor of peace and stability. So that's the starting point.
Right. Well, that's not only a starting point. I think that's the new architecture. That's the new framework. And the phrase you used in a conversation before was rethinking statecraft. I think you've just laid out the architecture of a new foreign and defense policy. So I think you're really onto it. I think it's the direction we need to go. And this may sound like a very simplistic analogy, but just to kind of bring it home for our listeners here, it strikes me a little bit parallel to the shift that happened as women started to rise up in our society with the second wave of the women's movement in the 1970s, was that before it had been assumed, oh, well, the men will take care of everything and the men have to take care of the women. And then the women were like, well, thank you very much, but we can take care of ourselves and we can help take care of our families. So as the men kind of stepped back a little bit with the women and the families, the women came forward and they're now major economic contributors to the family and equal partners in families. So, you know, maybe as the U.S. steps back from kind of the misguided sense that we can solve the problems of the world, that then that creates more space for others to take responsibility for their own thing, and then it's less likely that other countries are going to attack us and criticize us because we're trying to monkey in and solve issues in areas of the world we're not being successful at doing it, and we're just in some ways hurting ourselves. In fact, I think once upon a time, didn't you teach a class and you were talking about why do the other countries hate us? Why do people in other countries hate us? So I think it actually could increase our standing in the world to have more of a multilateral view, don't you?
Oh, I absolutely think that's right. In fact, not only would I say is that necessary, for many of these problems, a multilateral approach is the only solution. We can't solve climate change alone. It's a global problem. We don't begin to have the resources to solve the problem of global inequality alone. We do not have anywhere near the capacity to solve the problem of 60 million displaced people around the world as a result of conflict and economic distress. These are all issues that can only be addressed on a multilateral basis, and they can't be addressed if the United States walks in with a design and says, here's the design, now everybody get on board. That's a very different view of American statecraft. That's a message of necessity, of cooperation and collaboration. It, axiomatically, we cannot address any of those problems in any other way. So we might, for example, with climate change, we might agree to rejoin the Paris Accord. We are, after all, one of the biggest polluters on the planet, much a lot higher than our share of planet gross domestic product. But we and we alone can't solve that issue. The Chinese have to be solving that issue, and they're addressing it. The Japanese have to be solving that issue. The Germans have found ways to address it. We live in this country on the assumption that we have the only answers. And, you know, it's not true whether it's health care or climate change. We don't have the only answers to health care. Our health care system produces the worst results at the highest cost of all the industrialized countries, but we're very xenophobic in that sense. We only look at ourselves and say, we Americans have the only answer. Well, that's now counterproductive. So if we're going to organize effective approaches to climate change, to migration, to economic inequality in the world, we're only going to be able to do it through a process of cooperation and collaboration multilaterally. It will not happen all alone. So just in American diplomacy, there is a crying need to refocus on how we work multilaterally. And that's just not, I'm not standing here and saying everything needs to go through the UN. It may be that the UN is not the appropriate instrument for dealing with some of these powers. Paris Accord is not a UN organization. You suit the organization to the problem, but we have to deal with these problems on a multilateral basis.
Right, exactly. I think that's it. The rethinking statecraft relies a lot on collaboration and cooperation. And, you know, as we move more towards this multilateral view of the world, it's really recognizing the fact that that is what we have. It's not that we're going to reshape the world to be multilateral. It already is. We just need to recognize that. You talk about the rising emerging regional powers. You know, we've got China on the rise. We've got India on the rise, Iran on the rise, and so forth. That when we shift to that multilateral view, we could eliminate the perceived need for this, the fact that the United States now has 800 military bases all over the world. I don't know if our listeners, most people are not aware, the U.S. now has 800 military bases all over the world. When we shift to our thinking more multilateral, we could shut a lot of those bases down, right? And then that allows us to save money and cut the military spending. But we're doing it. We're not going in to say the military budget's too high, which it is. It's about $750 billion these days. Yes, of course that's too high. But in order to cut that spending, we need to do it in a way that's shaped around we need to pay what we genuinely need for our defense. But having power projection all over the world to solve all the world's problems, we don't have to have all 800 of these bases. How many of those bases do you think the U.S. really needs for our defense?
Well, it depends on what your policy is going to be. Let me give you some examples, because what I really like to say is that we've lost track of the sense that diplomacy and multilateral negotiations are also ways of guaranteeing security. They're not alternatives to security. They're ways of guaranteeing security. So let me give you just three examples of what that might mean, that are examples that deal with the question that you've raised, that is to say, how much are we spending on the military? I don't think you cut the defense budget just to cut the defense budget. I think you tailor a defense budget to what your security requirements are. But let me give you some examples about how to define that. Right now we're spending, I'm guessing, somewhere between $10 and $20 billion a year on cyber offensive operations, largely in the NSA and the Department of Defense. Now note I said cyber offensive operations. I'm not talking about cybersecurity and cyber defenses, although the agencies with the money would like you to think that the issue is protecting us. The $10 to $20 billion is money that is dedicated to attacking other countries. It's what we do, and we're already doing it. We've already done it with the Iranian nuclear program. We've already done it in Russia. We have routinely have a program of cyber offensive operations. Now, the promoters of cyber security will say, you have to do that. It's the only way to deter it. The reality is the military forces of the United States love to add cyber offensive operations to their weapons kit. This is another great weapon. So the way we justify doing it is we say, well, the Russians are attacking us, the Chinese are attacking us, the North Koreans are attacking us, the Iranians are attacking us. We just have to attack back. We've only recently begun to talk about the offensive operations that the United States government has undertaken. But let me take a step back and talk about where we started. It's a multilateral world. The reality is that cyberspace belongs to everybody. And everybody has an interest in protecting cyberspace. Everybody. From the individual person on Facebook to the major financial operations, of the international exchange operations that happen out of Luxembourg and London and so on, everybody depends on cyberspace. It is a natural structure for there to be an international agreement to defend cyberspace. Not a single country defense operation combined with an offensive operation, which only stimulates other offensive operations. But the United States government has never adopted a position, a negotiating, a diplomatic position, that says it's important to create an international regime for cyberspace. We've had such regimes. There is the non-nuclearization of outer space is such a regime. The law of the sea, which, by the way, the United States has not signed the not joined the Convention on the Law of the Sea. The law of the sea regulates activities in the sea. The International Air Transport Cooperation Organization ensures that flight routes and meteorological information and so on, airport locations, beams and so on, are all standardized, and the language is standardized, which ensures that everybody who goes through the air in aircraft is safe in their operations, right? So yep. It's not surprising that cyberspace is another one of those domains, if you will, areas of activity that are truly global. U.S. governments never had a negotiating position that sought an agreement on access to, use of, and restrictions on cyberspace. One of the major reasons, and I'm here to tell you this as somebody who participated in such discussions in Washington, in the Clinton administration, that the reason we don't have a government position that seeks an international diplomatic negotiation on cyberspace is because the Pentagon doesn't want it. And the Pentagon doesn't want it because the Pentagon and the military are committed to having offensive cyber operations in their toolkit. Anything that restricts them from cyber offense is something they do not want to see happen. So they're willing to risk insecurity around the world in the defense of cyber offensive operations for the United States military. And that literally has been the argument that has prevented the United States from developing a diplomatic program to regulate cyberspace. You can say the same about space in general. You can say the same thing about whether or not we need a global architecture of military bases to protect the global commons. There are alternatives to doing that, to the United States assuming that it has that role. And I will say, the United States has the only truly global military in the world. The only one. The Chinese do not have a global military. Only the United States. In the Clinton administration, I used to walk around with a briefing under my arm because policymakers, very senior officials, had no idea why we spent so much money on defense. And the reason we spent so much money on defense, beyond buying systems that contractors want to sell, is because we've given ourselves a global military mission. We defend, ostensibly, everything around the world. We need the capacity to intervene everywhere around the world. Well, if you move to a more restrained American foreign policy, where you do not assume that you have to intervene militarily around the world, then you don't need all of those bases, right? You need to define that policy. You need to shape what military installations you need that fit with that policy. But a substantial number of them could disappear because there's no reason to have the United States steaming everywhere in the world, flying everywhere in the world with its military, communicating everywhere in the world with its military. These no longer are as necessary if you assume a more restrained role for the United States military in a broader statecraft, a reformed statecraft, that engages the world and opens up all the opportunities that diplomacy can open up to provide security without having the military assume the job.
Right. That's awesome. And have you run the numbers at all? I know you're a brilliant numbers guy on top of having great architecture and policy knowledge and understanding. But have you run what would be... Like now we've got a military budget about $750 billion. If we reshape our policies to be more along the lines you're saying, where we're one of the players internationally, we're not trying to be the world's policeman, and we recognize pretty much all the major problems we're facing right now are international in scope, the refugees, the climate crisis, the economic inequality, of course we have that domestically as well as internationally, but if we move towards a more multilateral approach to our security, have you run the numbers? Like, what does our military budget come to with that approach?
We did an exercise of this kind, based in part on this rough outline of restraint, through an exercise that was coordinated by one of the think tanks in Washington about 2-3 years ago called the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And a group of us ran a restraint design. You know, if we restrained American military capacity along the lines of the policy engagement that we're talking about, what do we think we really need to guarantee American national security? Now, it's important as a starting point to point out that we probably spend more than the next 7 countries in the world combined on our on the military. And most of those countries are allies, no exception, the Russians and the Chinese. But we spend more than all those other countries combined. Interestingly, the number 2 military spender in the world, believe it or not, is Saudi Arabia. And they're proving that that doesn't provide them an iota of security because they can't even defeat the Houthis in Yemen right next door.
Mm-hmm.
So we're already spending a great deal. If you downscope the structure of the forces to fit a more restrained presence and a more restrained strategy of engagement, you're still going to have a military budget that is at least 3 times the size of China. It's probably $200 to $250 billion less per year than what we're now spending, somewhere in the $500 billion range. To sustain a force that is capable of deploying when necessary, that is capable of defending the frontiers of the United States, that is capable of ramping up into wartime if you run into wartime, God forbid. That's why you have diplomacy. You don't need to spend that much money. You need to spend maybe 2/3 of what we're now spending. But you have to have, it's not enough to say, okay, I want to cut the defense budget by 2/3. That's, in my judgment, at least a fairly simple-minded way of saying it. You want to say, I want to engage the world in a different way. I want regional security architectures where the United States is not the sole provider of military power. I'm going to accept the fact that other countries have military power. And by the way, we can't deny it to the Chinese. They're going to do it anyway, right? But that's a perfect example. The issue to be solved with China is, of course, South China Sea. But the Chinese have an intrinsic interest in having security of the high seas. Why? Because they're more dependent than we are on trade, and because probably 75% of their petroleum, oil, and lubricants come via sea. So the Chinese have a perfect reason to support the definition of an international regime that provides for ocean-going security. And Chinese ships can help ensure that security, as well as American ships can provide for that security. We're so committed to the principle that we're number one and the only provider of security that we don't look at those kinds of regimes.
Right, exactly. Well, that's fascinating. Have you run across Puck Mickleby in your travels?
Yes.
He's a retired Marine colonel who is a top strategic advisor of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, he's a very interesting fellow. I knew him a little bit. We talked at length about how to, because as you know, he was charged by the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with designing a new grand strategy for national security, and he focused on elevating the climate crisis as a national strategic imperative. You know, he understands that the climate crisis would lead, this is now 10 years ago, but he understood even then, the climate crisis would lead to food and water shortages, to climate disasters like hurricanes and floods, to the uptick in millions of refugees. So he recommended action for sustainability as a national security issue. What do you think of that approach?
Well, let me take a step back. I'm familiar with that study that Buck Mickleby was part of. And here's my fundamental problem. And it's no critique of that, because I thoroughly accept that defining the climate change as a major security issue is important. But, and here's a big but, and this is one of the weaknesses of American statecraft and one of the reforms of statecraft, one of the rethinkings, if you will, of American statecraft that we need to do. It makes no sense to ask the military to define our national security strategy. It makes no sense to have the military define our national security strategy. It sounds like it makes sense. But I've worked a lot with the military, and they're good people. I've worked with them a great deal, and some really good friends are people once in or in uniform. That's not the issue. The issue is military people think strategically, but they think strategically in a conservative conflict box, because that's how they're trained, and they're trained well, and they're very good at it. And the Defense Department has a whole architecture of people who can spend their time, as Buck Nickleby did, thinking about grand strategy and thinking about how to define America's engagement in the world. And after watching this for several years, 5 years in the White House, where I had responsibility for the defense budget, I had responsibility for the State Department budget, all the foreign assistance budgets, the intelligence budget, OMB's view in trade negotiations, and I realized something really important when I was there, which is the Pentagon is the only agency in the whole foreign policy universe that thinks strategically, supports strategic thinking, puts money into internal and external capacity to think strategically. They fund all these research organizations all over the map who do strategic thinking for them, and it is actually not advantageous for American national security to have the Pentagon doing all the thinking. It's fine they do thinking. I don't have a problem with it. The problem I have, and this takes us to how do we strengthen and rethink American statecraft, is that, you know, having watched the State Department up close and uncomfortably for 5 years, I can tell you that America's diplomats are not taught to think strategically where they go to school. DOD personnel are. The American diplomats do not have an in-house think tank worth looking at. The Defense Department has several. The State Department does not have the money and does not even think about trying to raise money to support outside strategic thinking for the State Department from a diplomatic perspective. The consequence of that is that in every interagency argument, every time I sat in the Situation Room at the table, there'd be three or four people from the Pentagon in uniform, out of uniform, good people. I'm not criticizing them. They're excellent people, and they do excellent thinking. And you'd have the Secretary of State, who was never a strategic thinker and had no research backup to give him strategic thinking. The diplomats didn't back it up because they aren't trained to do strategic thinking. They aren't trained to do planning. They aren't trained to do program implementation. They're trained to be gentlemen in suits. And that's a critical weakness of American statecraft, and one of the reasons that we tend to overuse the military in trying to achieve our foreign policy objectives and underuse our diplomacy is because our diplomatic tool is not sufficiently trained and skilled up and funded to do that job. So when we're rethinking American statecraft and redesigning it, one of the things that the next administration has got to do, it's not just hire more diplomats and give them more money. It is rethink diplomacy for the United States. So the diplomats are trained to think economically, to train to think in terms of climate change, trained to think strategically, trained to develop and run programs. So they're real hands-on operators and not just, negotiation's important, but not just negotiators. So it's not just a question of the military and the bases and the ships and the weapons. It's also a question of we have underskilled our diplomats. We've underused them and we've underskilled them, and God knows we've underfunded them.
Wow, that's fascinating. So we could add that whole strategic training component into the diplomatic corps.
Absolutely, and it's not there today, and they are disadvantaged, let me say, in the interagency process because they can't apply the tools, they don't own the tools, they don't know how to apply them. Our foreign policy is run by five or six different agencies all running around thinking they hold the ball and somebody else has got a piece of the ball. It's one of the most disorganized communities in American government and one of the least capable of strategic thinking. And the problem is, I'm not just criticizing them, it disempowers them.
Yeah, fascinating.
They don't carry the same weight.
Yeah, fascinating. So we just have about 5 minutes left. I have still 10 questions I want to ask you. So I want to move to this one. You, Trump has talked about immigrants coming into the United States as a great threat to our national security. How important do you think immigration is as a national security threat to us?
I don't think immigration is a national security threat to us at all, in any way, shape, or form. So the securitization of immigration is nothing but, you know, a concealed form of hostility, nativism, and in some cases pure racism. It doesn't really have to do with security. You know, security internally in our country is the job not of the military, it's the job of police forces and, you know, agencies of that kind, internal agencies that we've always had. And, you know, the data show that there is no higher incidence of crime among immigrant populations. There's no more likely to be murders among immigrant populations. In fact, generally, immigrants are less prone to criminal activity than your average American community. And the reason is they come here to survive, to make money, to grow, to help their families, to get away from jobless economies and insecure ganglands in other countries in the world. And that's why they're here. So, you know, you're pushing me, you're pushing an open door on immigration. It's not a security issue at all. I think it's completely miscast as a security issue. The big security issue, though, is how we as a world, this is now a multilateral issue, how we as a world deal with the reality of income inequality, climate change, and the migration of peoples, conflict and economics driving migration. We have more than 60 million people around the world today who are displaced. About 40 million of them displaced within their own countries, Syria, for example, and 20 million of them displaced in refugee camps somewhere else. This is a bleeding sore, and it has been the source of the nativism, both in Europe, see Hungary, for example, see Brexit and UK, for an example, and in the United States. The source of it is income inequality, and conflict, poor governance, a series of crises, including climate change and desertification and all of that, that contribute to people having to feel like they've got nothing to do except to leave their home and search for a better opportunity somewhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
All the foreign assistance in the world, all foreign aid in the world is not going to rebuild those economies and create jobs tomorrow. It's not going to. So we're going to have to address in the near term the problem of 60 million displaced people. Where do they go? How are they fed? How are they educated? Where are they trained? Can they go home? Do they have to be relocated somewhere else? How do we support the countries that are taking them in? This is a multilateral question. This is not a one country at the time issue. This is a serious multilateral question. The United States government under Donald J. Trump has no policy whatsoever on the multilateral level. There is no policy. There is nothing but rampant rhetoric and nativism as a policy, and that's not a policy. Right? So
we need both the short term and the long term. The near term, we got to figure out what do we do collectively with that multilateral approach you're talking about the 60 million people that are displaced, and we need to be working together as a global community to fix the problems at the home so people are less likely to leave their homes. They can stay at home and work and thrive there.
There's no way the United States can do that alone. There's no way the United States is an indispensable nation or exceptional in those terms. We've proved that with nativism, right? But it is the next president's job to establish immediately a multilateral approach to dealing with refugees, homeless, displaced, the 40 million in their own countries, the 20 million in other countries. These are a bleeding sore politically and economically around the world. So rather than jumping up and down in nativism, the next administration is going to have to work with other countries to figure out a global approach to how to deal with that.
Well said. And we have just 1 minute left, and I'm wondering if you could share with us, since you were one of the highest officials in government, for quite a number of years. What is the lesson the greatest lesson you learned working in the Clinton administration in charge of all the budgets of defense and intelligence and state and so forth? What's your greatest lesson?
Well, maybe two, because one lesson's never enough, right? The first lesson I learned working particularly at the senior level of policymaking is personality matters. It was stunning to me, actually. Personality matters. The human interrelations among policymakers are cannon fodder for commentators and gossipers, and for a good reason. There's a bad reason, too. It makes great press and sells media. But the good reason is the character of the people in those jobs matters. I'll give you an example from even before my time. Look, Richard Holbrooke.
That's our signal. We're out of time. Thank you so much, Gordon Adams. Really appreciate all your good work.
Thanks for having me.